Thank you very much, David. Most of us are here not just for the information, important as that is, and we're going to move on now to what we do about it. I'd like to ask Sherry McDonald to begin. Sherry is going to get on with some of the practical things about how we can help get this movement going.
Hi. Can you hear me? Yeah? I'd just like to ask the young people, the marshals who have the buckets, wait till the end of my talk. And I know everybody's now saying, what? Buckets? Damn, what's the smallest bill I've got here? Damn those instant tellers that only give you $20 bills. But I'm here to try and get you to change your mind. I think in order to understand the MAI, you have to understand, first of all, the assumption underlying much of economic policy today. The assumption that the root of our problems is that the rich don't have enough money and the poor have too much. That's why governments can give subsidies to corporations at the same time that they cut welfare and social programs for the rest of us. And the MAI is kind of like that. It says that the problem is that Exxon and General Motors don't have enough power and you and I have too much. When I got a letter inviting me to speak here from People Against the MAI, it said on the top, people before profits. I knew then I was dealing with a dangerous subversive group. If Jean Chrétien believed in people before profits, the Canadian government would go to the banks and the bondholders and would say, thank you for supporting Canada's social programs. We won't be paying the interest we owe. We need the money for the social programs. These are hard times, after all, and the banks will just have to tighten their belts. But our government seems to always get it backwards. When I first heard about a multilateral agreement on investment, I thought it sounded like a good idea. There'd be some rules for the game. I'd be in favor of it if it were our MAI. If it were our MAI, we'd be able to take legal action against the corporations that threaten the maintenance of social programs, like the big drug companies. Anybody think that's a good idea? If it were our MAI, we'd be able to say to the mining and textile companies, don't think because you're in another country, you can destroy the environment and pay slave wages. Under our MAI, Canadian citizens will prosecute. Think that's a good idea? If it were our MAI, there would be an expropriation clause. When a company tells workers to accept pay cuts or they'll close it down, or when it tells the government that they'll shut the plant if environmental legislation is passed, we'd say, if you can't run a decent business, we'll expropriate and pass it along to those that can, maybe even a workers' collective. Anybody like that idea? And if it were our MAI, we'd say to corporations, be careful about that expropriation stuff. A lot of land around here was expropriated from the native peoples, and they just could expropriate it back. Hey. But it's not our MAI, and you've heard about the effects of the MAI as it is proposed. Now, I know this is a little hard, get up some energy tonight, but what I'd like you to do, you've heard the people speaking about the MAI and what it means. I'd like to invite you to be creative here. I'd like to invite you to give a little bit of a free-form response. I'd like to invite you to just holler out whatever you think of it. Could I hear something there? A little more? You can holler whatever you want, a little more. Now, the important thing, I think, is what we heard just now from Dave. And that is that in these hard times, the struggle against the MAI has a good chance of success, and God knows we need some victories. He pointed to many indications which show us that we could win this one. A lot of the provincial and territorial governments are already voicing concerns about the MAI. There's a promising legal challenge going forward. And to me, most significantly, I think, the president of the Business Council on the National Interest has felt so beleaguered about the MAI that he's reduced to attacking you in the press. Did you read the article where he said that crowds who come out to hear speeches like this are just rent-a-crowds and don't mean a thing? To me, that shows how under attack he feels. I think we can win this. It just needs a little extra push. This is a real grassroots organization here, and there's a lot of problems that go along with that. First of all, the revolution will not be government funded. And secondly, the search for corporate donors has not been fruitful. So that leaves you and I to pay for booking the halls, publishing the literature, and there is a very useful package of literature available. I'm going to use it in my school class. So that's why I'm here to appeal to you tonight to help us with that, because I think that if we have that little extra push, we can win this one. And I can promise you that all the monies collected here in this hall will go to the struggle and to public education, and absolutely none of it will be invested in multinational corporations. Now, I do have a little idea of how to make it easier to give. Although I look around the crowd, I see, not surprisingly, there's a lot of unemployed people here, I think. I'm addressing, first of all, the ones who are employed. If you're unemployed, I hope you'll give as much as you can, but I'm going to really guilt trip the ones who have jobs. Now, I was invited here by the Scientists for Peace, and I want to tell the scientists in the audience that careful and well-replicated research has established an indisputable fact. Monday is the crummiest day. Social scientists use words like alienation. That means the feeling that you're working like a dog while the boss stands by waiting to siphon off profits from your labor. Going into work on Monday is pretty blah. So my idea is a way to make Monday more attractive. Donate the wages from your first hour of work this Monday to people against the MAI. Then you'll go into work full of energy, and you'll tell the boss, I can hardly wait to get down to work because I have donated the first hour to a movement to smash the whole anti-environment, anti-worker, anti-woman, bourgeois agenda. Get your coffee, take a letter. Now, again, I'm particularly addressing those who, be honest with yourself, can afford to give more than the $5 you gave at the door. Unemployed people also donate their time, and I guess that's one of the silver linings of the MAI. By creating more unemployment, we'll have more people available to do the political organizing. Now, I don't like to guilt trip people too much, but you know how it is. Sometimes you see two people sitting together. One of them's unemployed. And she says, I'm really pissed off. We can't let the government get away with this. The ruling class thinks they own the place. Oh, they do. I'm going to put this $20 in the bucket, even if it means no more beer or cigarettes. And she goes ahead. The other one sitting beside her has a good job, says, I worked 5 minutes for that $20. No way I'm putting it in the bucket. I'm asking you to consider giving your first Monday hour's wage to the people against the MAI, or giving as close as you can get. Now, here's a second heavy guilt trip. When you look around at the marshals that are passing the buckets, these are the young people, these are the students from Oberg. These are the very people that often struggle hard to get an education. But once they graduate, they often only get hard, sweaty work. They have a heavy burden to carry. If you're employed, don't oppress and overburden them even more by throwing heavy coins into the buckets. Lighten their labor with a little paper money. But if you have no paper, coins will do too. Remember, a $20 bill does not even take you and a companion to the movies and buy popcorn. And after the MAI, there might be no Canadian movies to see anyhow. You might consider putting in the $20 that you saved by boycotting Maple Leaf products. You might consider putting in $20, $1 for every year that Canada will be locked into the MAI. Or you might consider putting in your first hour's wages on Monday, and instead of working that hour for the corporations or the government, working an hour for people against the MAI, working an hour for yourself. Where are those buckets? Do the best.
best that you can, because I think the first step we have to do is to get more people right here into this hall to do more education around it. And as I said, the governments, the corporations aren't funding us. So help out as much as you can. Thanks.
Thank you. While the buckets are going around, I'd like to ask John Vallow to come back, who's going to explain something about the legal action involved.
Thank you, Lynn. That's a tough act to follow, I'm afraid. As I said before, our principal job, it seems to me, is public education, because of the political effect, the long-term political effect, as well as the short-term, that will have. But there is a second string to our bow that is just worth taking a moment to think about, and that's a possible legal challenge to the MAI. So is the MAI legal? Well, probably not. And several grounds for challenging it have been proposed. I won't go through them all. Two of them are constitutional, and I'll just mention those. First one concerns national sovereignty. The question is, can a government, by signing a foreign treaty, bind future governments in such a way that they may be unable to discharge their constitutional responsibilities? And this is clearly entailed here because of the 20-year limit that David and Sherry have both mentioned. We can't get out of it. So succeeding governments are trapped and won't be able to do what they may feel is correct for the country. The second ground, the constitutional ground, concerns the division of powers. So it's a federalism case. And that is the question whether a national government can, by signing a foreign treaty, remove the rights and responsibilities assigned to subordinate governments, such as provincial governments, by the Constitution. It also involves the Aboriginal peoples, because they have, of course, rights and indeed have been assured that they will have further rights for self-government, and those too would be diminished or removed by the MAI. Those are the two constitutional grounds. The legal advice so far is that the second of those grounds is the easier one to pursue, although they're both strong cases. Concerning the second one, there is a ruling from the Privy Council of the House of Lords, 1937, which says, in part, it would be remarkable that while the Dominion could not initiate legislation, however desirable, which affected civil rights in the provinces, yet its government need only agree with a foreign country to enact such legislation. Such a result would appear to undermine the constitutional safeguards of provincial constitutional autonomy. In other words, a Dominion cannot, merely by making promises to foreign countries, clothe itself with legislative authority inconsistent with the Constitution which gave it birth. So this was the ruling of the Privy Council and would be the prime ruling on which such a case would be based. The case against NAFTA was also considered, as many of you know, and it was never pursued, although it might well have been successful. But the experts we've consulted believe that the challenge against the MAI is incomparably stronger, and indeed likely to be successful. It's incomparably stronger because NAFTA purports to be a trade agreement, and the federal government does indeed have jurisdiction over trade matters. But investment, on the other hand, resides in a province, and therefore is clearly a provincial matter, and so the case is very much stronger. Well, what's gone on? A good deal of organizing and planning has been begun, most notably by a group in Vancouver called the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee, which centers around a legal office there run by Constance Fogel. Now, they badly need our financial help if they're going to proceed with this challenge. And so one of the things which I will encourage you to do is to consider, those who are able, to consider sending a check to the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee. I'll give information on that. We have organized from PAMA so far several thousands of dollars in contributions to their work. But that it will simply be a drop in the bucket if they proceed with the case. The money so far is being used to prepare the preparatory material on carrying out the case. Meanwhile, it will be even better if we can get a provincial government to launch the case, for a reason especially that I'll mention in a moment. if they did so, then any of us, including the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee, could hopefully intervene in such a case and therefore come before the courts. But there's a wrinkle which is very important. None of us probably can get standing before the courts until the agreement is signed. The reason for that is that there is nothing definite against which to make a claim previous to the actual signing of the treaty. So that seems to mean that a lot of damage would be done before we could do anything legally. But the case for the provincial governments is quite a different one, because any provincial government can require of its own courts a ruling on anything they like, for example, on the legality of a draft treaty, and therefore could bring this before the courts immediately. And so the second task, as well as trying to get some money for the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee, the second task is to try to persuade at least one provincial government to launch such a case, and to do it very quickly. So a lot of pressure is being put on certain governments, most especially British Columbia, which, as already mentioned, has objected to the MAI and indeed has threatened not to comply with it publicly, repeatedly. And so there is some hope that they would be interested in launching such a case, and indeed they are known to be considering doing so. Any assistance you can give by writing to Clark and the provincial government in British Columbia, encouraging them and asking them to act on our behalf, would be very, very useful. There are others. PEI and the Yukon have both passed measures in their legislature objecting to the MAI and so on, and other provinces might join in. I'm not very optimistic that any of them would themselves launch a case, but they might, so it's worth writing to those governments as well. It certainly makes a difference to write to such people. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We are now going to move to question period. There are two mics. I will begin with the mic there with the patient people who have been waiting.
Hello?
There.
Hello? Is this on?
And ask people to be brief in questions and to please do to direct your question to which speaker you wish. You have the mic,
yes.
Sir. Yes.
My name is Gus Hahn. I'm active in the MAI campaign and a whole bunch of other issues. But I have three suggestions to make about these meetings. I've been to four of them now, big meetings on MAI, including this one. And one thing is I think I never see an NDP leader on the platform. Where are the NDP? The organizers should make sure they're on the platform. That's one suggestion. The other suggestion is that there's not enough time for audience participation. And the other comment is that they go on too long. Good night.
I'll take the next two at this mic. People have been there for a long time. I did see Marilyn Shirley in the audience. I don't know if she's still here now, but I did see her earlier today, certainly. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name's Christine Fulda, and I'm a member of the Ontario Health Coalition. I want to thank Elizabeth, Gordon, David, for speaking out tonight. Some of you might be putting yourselves at risk for some of this activity. And your analysis and understanding of these so-called investment opportunities agreements is dead on. I would like to beg from you 2 minutes to expand your comments into the area of healthcare, because debate on what is actually happening to healthcare or has been happening is not much of that going on. Can I have those 2 minutes?
Who would like to take to David?
She's asking. I'm addressing the panelists. I'm thanking them for having attended tonight and spoken out. I'm a healthcare activist. Mm-hmm. And I would like 2 minutes to expand all of their comments into the area of healthcare.
2 minutes, yes.
Okay. Now, investment is a code word for control. And that control is through management of public assets. That's what's happening right now to all of our public services. Real power does not lie solely with ownership. That's passé. Anyone who has ever perused ancient Persian and Chinese history knows that real power lay with the inner palace eunuchs. So for the last 30 years, we have had the Harvard and MIT inspired, we have endured the aforementioned with their supply side economics, and we have endured their efficiency professionals. Briefly, their theory is this: create chaos, economics theory of creative destruction, create scarcity. So that scarcity then becomes a blue chip commodity. Number two, control that scarcity through cartels, vertically integrated behemoths, micromanagement, and target marketing. Number three, gatekeep access. So in healthcare, this is what has been happening. It's soothingly called regional accountable health plans or integrated delivery systems. Now, this is an insurance concept that is borrowed from military systems thinking. Remember the Vietnam War? In the 1920s and 30s, this was known as organized capitalism, or simply put, cartels. Today, it is known as managed competition. The more things change, the more they remain the same. So this is not peculiar to healthcare. This is, in essence, the NAFTA, the MAI, private sector access of public assets. This is a global Ponzi scheme. In healthcare, it comes out basically as this: sign them all up, rostering, phony universality. Two, gatekeep access, cherry picking and redlining. Three, limit treatment so that specialists or hospital care is limited only to the blue chip few. Remember, scarcity, only accessible for the target market, the blue chip few.
Okay, so the panelists. You've had your 2 minutes, and we have a lot of other speakers, so I'd like to thank you for your contribution.
Can you relate
but we'll
this
have
back
to move
to
on
your
to
areas
other people.
Of expertise. That's finished. Mm-hmm.
I'll take one speaker there, and then the first three here. One questioner, and please direct your question.
Oh, I just had three short points. I can say it pretty fast. Is that all right?
Very fast.
Okay. It seems to me that one of the big problems right now is that because the companies are operating internationally, it seems that we're at a stage in the development of the world where it's almost like we need some sort of, no matter what we do, even if we eliminate these agreements, there's nothing to prevent companies from operating internationally. We can't stop that. It seems to me now we're at a point where we need almost like a very strong international court that has real clout as far as creating international labor laws, international environmental laws, international laws to stop child labor. Like, we're sort of at a point that, and unions too, we have to start operating internationally, because that's, we can't give the companies anywhere to go, basically, is what I'm thinking.
Could I comment on that? First of all, before anyone else leaves the room, I'm kicking myself that I didn't mention earlier. This Thursday, March 19th, is a day of action on the MAI at the same time as the Liberal Policy Convention is taking place in Ottawa. We're specifically asking people to target their MPs. So you can get information from Council of Canadians or Sierra Club or any of the other groups involved. What you've raised is the critical issue, and that is that globalization need not be a one-way ratchet down on healthcare and the environment and labor standards and all the things it has been. There is no reason that we couldn't create at an international level protections for all these things, because even if we can protect our environment and labor standards in Canada, you're right, countries around the world are being, and peoples around the world are suffering much more than we are from these excesses. And so the real solutions lie in international reforms and in building in very, very different kinds. Sherry McDonald, Sherry? Yeah, that is the version of the MAI we want. We want something that constrains the activities of corporations who, living through their only raison d'etre to maximize short-term profits to shareholders, will inevitably compromise the labor and environmental standards in a world where the orthodoxy is competitiveness. So we have to turn that on its head, and it doesn't have to be. It's not saying we can do purely domestically. You're right. We will probably be moving towards strong international standards, whether it's a World Environment Organization that's as strong as the World Trade Organization, or through treaty negotiations. But our ability to negotiate treaty negotiations, even now, the Kyoto Protocol has no enforcement mechanisms because Canada said, among others, that we would not sign the protocol if it included trade sanctions as an enforcement mechanism. That's the only effective sanction for protection of the environment in international treaties. We used it in the Montreal Protocol. We used it to protect the Trade and Endangered Species Convention and the Basel Convention on Hazardous Waste. But this time, Canada said we wouldn't sign if it was in there. So the World Trade Organization is already having a chilling effect on any new international treaties to protect the environment.
I guess the point I was trying to make is that, I mean, there's nothing wrong with ethical business. It's just that we have to find a way of keeping these companies. It's fine if companies set up all over the world if they're acting in an ethical way, if they're hiring, if they're treating workers right, if they're creating jobs. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is so many of them are not. A couple more points I want to make.
There's a long line at the mic, so thank you for your contribution, but I will move on to the first three speakers at the other mic. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairwoman. As far as I'm concerned, MAI is the ultimate golden rule, being the men with the gold make the rule. Having said that, I think I have to ask David, when he says that we have to get out of NAFTA, why don't you include FTA too? I mean, we might as well make the pain short and in 6 months get rid of both of them.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean when I said NAFTA. It has to be out of both of them.
Oh, okay. I'm glad you included that. All right. Well, as already mentioned, this weekend is the big thing Liberal do in Ottawa. How many people here are going there? I mean, that's important. You have to be there, canvassing the delegates coming in and out. It's no use if you say that Liberals are vulnerable and we are going to sit here. So if you can manage to get out to Ottawa this weekend, get out and hustle the delegates. They are still vulnerable, just like the MPs were last time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just comment. I just want to comment just before the next questioner. I forgot to mention that the Liberals have put out a propaganda sheet that they're mailing to people. Some of you will have seen it, defending their position. They're mailing it out very aggressively and attacking the critics of the MAI. And we've done a special issue of True North responding point by point to the Liberal propaganda on MAI. So this people may find this helpful to study this when you're taking them on.
You have the floor.
A question, maybe perhaps most appropriate to Elizabeth May. In Ontario and further north, we have an idiot stick program run by the provincial government called Lands for Life, which basically is the handover of some 46% of the province's land base to the forest industry. That is going on fairly unchallenged in many parts of the north, and I'm not sure people in the south are too aware of it. And Elizabeth, I guess the question I would ask of you is, how do you see that? I personally see it as part of this corporate agenda, and maybe you could comment on it and enlighten us on something that is going on a little bit, or actually quite a bit, very extensively, right in our own province.
Thank you for asking the question. I'll correct you slightly. It's a giveaway of 46 million hectares, not just the forest industry, but the mining industry, too. We don't want to leave out their interest in also destroying the environment in Ontario. So what's going on in the Lands for Life process? There's material outside. I don't want to take too long. People have to be aware of this. The questioner is absolutely dead on. This is part of the agenda of corporate control. What the Harris government has announced is it they did it in a spin that made it sound like they were considering doing something nice for the environment by creating new parks. This is the last chance to create any new protected areas in the bulk of the province, 46% of the land base, because once they finish the quote-unquote lands for life process, which is definitely an Orwellian term of phrase, everything else that isn't a park, a little island in a wasteland, is going to be turned over to corporate interests, as it already is. Every stick of forest in the western part of the province, throughout the province, is already leased to forest companies on long-term leases. The difference is, under the Harris government, that not only does the rate of cut go up, the jobs go down, and in the meantime, the forest industry will be its own policeman. There will be no other regulations overseeing the exploitation of resources by the forest and mineral sector. They will be expected, as a cost-cutting measure, of course, because MNR staff has been so slashed, that they will turn themselves in when they've destroyed fish habitat or when they've cut in ways that are illegal. And so that's the common sense revolution, and you have to get involved. There'll be a Queen's Park open house on March 31st, please get involved. Contact Sierra Club, Wildlands League, Earth Roots, and find out more about it. It is part of the same agenda, and it is closer to home.
So we are seeing MAI in action in Ontario as we speak.
Well, this is the difference in Lands for Life is that you don't have to be a foreign corporation to get all the advantages. Any corporation can take the resources and run. But if a future government tried to change the rules, the foreign governments could sue. Foreign corporations, sorry.
Okay. Thanks. Elizabeth, next speaker at this mic.
About the Land for Life, it is a beautiful land, but the kind of destruction of the boreal forest will link to the climatic changes. We all know about the climatic changes will affect our daily life. So the March 31st meeting will be held on 900 Bay Street, McDonald Block, from 2 p.m. to 9 p.m. You can call the hotline more information. That is 416-971-WILD. I want to ask Elizabeth, what will be the impact of MAI on, first, our forest, and the second, on the environment?
I'll try to answer the question briefly in deference to questioners who are waiting. The impact of the MAI on our forest would be, basically, it's very hard in hypothetical examples because they are extremely numerous. In almost any circumstance you can envision where a foreign corporation in the future, if the MAI came to pass, was in any way annoyed with government regulations, I think they would be likely to be able to, they can sue under the MAI in any event, even if they have no cause, so I think frivolous suits will become extremely common. They can sue whenever they like. I think the chilling effect of governments being afraid that if they take action, they will be sued, maybe even more profound than the actual times that the governments lose in their private, behind-closed-doors dispute resolution process. And lastly, when you think of examples such as right now, most logging in Canada takes place on Crown land owned by the people of Canada. And those agreements are extremely favorable to the forest companies. If a future government provincially tried to renegotiate tenure agreements or stumpage fees in a way that a foreign forest company did not like, they would be able to sue. If, for instance, there's a foreign company that wants to start a mining operation in a sensitive ecosystem, if they're turned down and the area is made into a park, they can sue. These are just some examples.
Okay. Thanks, Elizabeth. I'll take the next two speakers at that mic and then continue.
But my question is directed to Gordon Peters. The Aboriginal community for a long time has had difficulty getting its story out and to get good understanding of the situation in which they find themselves, which hasn't just happened overnight, but it is historically the situation that they have not been treated fairly by the media, by the education system, so forth and so on. And we have an example of how that's acting with MAI. You may or may not have noticed there are no representatives of the major media here. They were all told about this, but there's none of them here. We have CIUT, and we welcome Aboriginal Voices, and also the Susan Coonan from Mogison Telegraph, associated with CIUT. And as many of you know, you get information about MAI not from the major dailies, which are part of the corporate structure. The Star has written some articles, I must admit, but very little. They don't want you to know about it, so you have to buy the alternative press, whether it's Canadian Forum, Briar Patch. They've all got good articles. councils, and that's where you get your information. But I would like to ask Gord how he feels about this in terms of how the Native community has been eclipsed, as it were. We used to have Native Voice, Native Land on CBC. It's been gone for some time. It was a great program. Gord?
Thank you. It is true that at this stage right now that we have very little capability to be able to deal with the communications of our issues to the Canadian public at large, and to be able to communicate a lot of times with our own communities concurrently across the country. The major difficulties that we've had are difficulties that groups, any kind of action group or any kind of social committee will take on, is because obviously you're fighting against the mainstream, and the mainstream doesn't want to be able to advance your position for them. The same thing happened to us in Meech Lake when we dealt with CBC. They said their mandate was to deal with Unity for Canada, and as a consequence, we couldn't get on CBC to give our view of what we thought about the Meech Lake Accord. And so we're struggling with the major media in this country because major media is under the same wraps as with the corporations, and they're under the same wraps with government who are supporting that process. And so the only way that we continue to get messages out there is through the local media. We try to do it through editorials. We visited editorial boards. We try to get boards to try to deal with us in some way. But it's just a constant struggle to try to get information to people about the effects that it has on Indigenous people and the effects that it has on Canadian people in general.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next questioner at that mic.
I'm not quite sure who this question is for, so for anyone who wants to answer it, I'm asking what's been done in terms of public education for investors to increase investor responsibility in terms of individuals with mutual funds and also in terms of businesses and to involve them in the struggle at all.
I couldn't hear that. Can you say it a little slower? I missed your question.
Her question was what has been done to educate people about the impact of investments like RSPs and pension funds and how...
And mutual funds and also businesses who to increase education of investors as to where their investments are going and also how they can invest in responsible actions.
Yeah, there's certainly, this is a bit distinct from the question of the MAI, but there's certainly a movement for ethical investment funds. There's been outreach from, I know Sierra Club has held meetings to try to educate people before making their RSP contributions to think about where that money is going. Because in a lot of ways, we inadvertently and without knowing are supporting activities of mining corporations moving into Latin America, doing things that we would never want to feel that we were part of. And that's been
just an add-on, those who, to know whether or not the in places you're investing or investing, or, sorry, are pro-MAI or not pro-MAI, to see where their stance is on it, where the investment's going, what stance it is.
Okay. Questioner there.
My question actually relates to the last question. It kind of ties in. This kind of agreement can be pretty disempowering for individual people, and I'm wondering if until we stop the MAI and get out of NAFTA, if there is a list of foreign corporations that we can boycott or somehow make choices not to buy their products?
The answer to the question is the virtual, and it gets back to the last questioner. The Business Council on National Issues in Canada, which represents the largest corporations, virtually all the large Fortune 500 corporations, the biggest ones in the country, are all in favor of the MAI. The International Chamber of Commerce drafted the MAI. You'd sort of have to boycott it, everybody except something that you knew was really inherently small and local and community-based. What I do want to add so that we don't need to wait to fight the MAI through Parliament. We need to kill it before negotiations finish in the OECD, and we need to track it if they try to bring it back at the WTO. The plan with this agreement is to finish it at the OECD and then force it down the throats of all the developing countries who said no the first time at the WTO. The plan is to take it to the WTO from the OECD. So I know that was just an alphabet soup. I'm sorry it's late. But what you need to do is focus on the fact that we put pressure now. We never let this get into our parliament. It's killed before it gets to that stage, and that we can do through political action. You raise a very good point. Which corporations are behind this? Virtually all transnational corporations want this agreement.
I'll just make a comment on that if I could. It's becoming a real struggle to even find where things are made. Like, it's important to do what you can even in your supermarkets to find out where your food is coming from, because they're labeling it less and less, so it's hard to find out whether it's coming from the United States or Canada and, of course, or other countries. And as a farmer, I can tell you, all of our major farm machinery producers have been driven out of business. So if I want to cultivate my land, I've got to use an American tractor and drive a Mack truck and all of those things. We used to have Massey Harris, Massey Ferguson, that was known around the world, and you could buy that kind of machinery. Now we're in a situation where we have to buy foreign-produced machinery, and it's an absolute crime. Canada should be producing all of that machinery. We've got all the resources to be able to do so, but we no longer have those industries to choose from.
Just to add to what David just said and what he said in his speech and in response to the last question, there's three little words to look for, and they aren't "I love you." They're "made in Canada." And sometimes it is multinational capital that owns the country, but it's a Canadian that has the job. It's the Canadian that's working, and it helps to stimulate the East-West trade in this country that David Orchard spoke about, and that's something we can do to help drive NAFTA underground in a way.
Let me just tell you, if the MAI came through... Sorry, your point is excellent. If the MAI were to come through, another thing in it that we haven't touched on yet tonight is that it would prevent governments from policies for procurement of things made in Canada. Governments would not be able to say, we're going to make a point of buying made in Canada products. We wouldn't be able to run advertising campaigns to buy made in Canada products. We would not be able to say to a foreign investor who came into Canada, we want a certain percentage of those jobs to go to Canadians. Performance requirements would go down the tubes. National treatment would rule, which means every foreign corporation would have equal access to any of our markets, any of our opportunities. And made in Canada is, I struggle. I wish to God I could buy a Barbie that was made in Canada, because I've got a 6-year-old girl and I will not buy something made in China. And I have a very serious problem. But in any event, please, someone out there, become a Canadian entrepreneur and make some crummy little plastic thing I can give my daughter.
I feel the opposition to this in Canada is paramount, but what is going on with the other countries? Are they opposing the MAI?
The New Zealand Parliament has been extremely active with debates. New Zealand, the public is up in arms. In Iceland, there have been street demonstrations and activities. In the UK, in France, the Minister of Culture came out publicly and said that they had been excluded at the beginning of the negotiations and they would not let that happen again. They're very involved. There have been demonstrations and activities and a citizens' movement that is going global, and it's growing all the time. In the U.S., Public Citizen Ralph Nader's group sent handcuffs to every member of the U.S. Congress and Senate to say, these are your MAI handcuffs. It's coming. Why don't you shackle your right to do anything?
Thank you.
I'll just comment that I just want to second that France has been a key opponent of this, and there's an excellent article in last week's Manchester Guardian, an interview with the French cultural minister in which she talks about how French culture would be wiped out by the American giants. And so France has taken a fairly the strongest stand to date, and there's talk about France even considering pulling out, and that would be a significant development if they would do so.
What does the MAI claim to be giving to governments, people, or whatever, in return for all the obligations that it's granting?
It's interesting. They don't think they have to give anything. It's the privilege to be able to continue to attract foreign investment. What's interesting is foreign direct investment is doing so very well. One wonders what the problem is that requires an MAI to allow the increased flow of direct investment.
Well, how can it be a valid agreement if there's no consideration?
Oh, this is a very good point. Not only is there no consideration, the prime beneficiaries aren't even contracting parties. The corporations aren't negotiating it, but they're the only winner in the MAI. They're not at the table, but they control the players.
This is, if I could, this is... This is really about these agreements are really a return to the kind of world that Charles Dickens wrote about in the Industrial Revolution, when there was no restrictions on the operations of these corporations at all. And that's what's being pushed now, is an attempt to roll back the gains that have been made over the last century in terms of so-called civilization, putting some kind of controls on private wealth. And that's the kind of battle that we're in right now. And it can be reversed. There's not when it comes to the ballot box, corporations can't elect. They have to have the votes of the people, and so people still have power in their hands. So it's a reversible kind of a thing.
Thank you. I'd like to turn the floor over to John Vallo, who's going to wind it up and thank the speakers.
Thank you. I just at this point simply want to give a great vote of thanks to our three great speakers here, and to Lynn McDonald for chairing. Now, thanks to all of you for coming and being with us tonight.